I don't think we've met before, but I'm the referee on this field.
Leinster could offer me $5 million a year, I wouldn't go.
It is Johnny Moe!
Robbie Robbie's weekly.
Little reverse pass. Oh! Oh!
Magic!
How's it going, the 42 members? Gavin here again, and still joined by Bernard Jackman. We're carrying on from the regular Thursday pod today with a bonus Lions edition of the members pod. Bert, are you still well?
Yeah, still well. Let's go.
Let's go. We want to get through a few questions from members that we didn't quite get a chance to go through earlier in the regular pod. We were joined by Gary Doyle for that one, and we did get stuck into Leinster and Ulster's defeats over the weekend as well, and the bigger picture there. So tune into that one maybe before even listening to this one if you like. I want to start with this question from Padraig, actually, Bernard, as it pertains to the Lions. He said, can you discuss, is it the best squad of players or is it the best squad that will play how Gatland wants them to, looking at how his teams have played in the past and the backroom team he has assembled? It's a decent place to start because I guess there are a couple of players we mentioned earlier. Bundy Aki's inclusion, for example, is a quintessential example of what Gatland likes to do rather than who we might have anticipated being in the squad.
Yeah, it is. But then Conan probably is a little bit left field. He's not that real power kind of athlete that that Gats tends to go for. So obviously someone like Billy Munafola would have been a guy we all thought was nailed on. Now I would have fancied Faletau to start at eight, even with Billy in the squad. But definitely Bundy seems to be a Gatland type selection. And I think, look, I think it's definitely a squad that has a lot of debating points. I mean, there was big strong rumors Sam Simmons is going to get in, and he does, and I think he is a really good athlete. Tip Rick is tried and tested. He's a top end player. A lot of Scots in it. Obviously people there's a lot of people look for Hamish Watson. He gets in, but probably Chris Harris. You know, Ali Price for me was a bit of a surprise. There was talk about even Danny Kerr when Ben Young's pulled out, but Price gets the nod there. So I think it's a fair mix. I think Greg Brown's gonna be part of his coaching squad. I think he's definitely pushed for more Scots. They did have a decent tournament. So they're pretty similar to Ireland in terms of the representation, I think.
You mentioned earlier in the regular pod that you wouldn't necessarily disagree with Owen Farrell's inclusion and that you reckon by the time push comes to shove, he'll be well capable of handling himself and producing some of that form of old. Are you surprised at all? Maybe you're not surprised. Sorry, let me change the question. Do you think it's right that, say, England, who finished fifth in the Six Nations, have the most players in this squad? Because they are ultimately coming in from a run of collective form that left a lot to be desired, and yet they are the dominant presence in this overall squad.
Yeah, but they were in a World Cup final. They won the Autumn Cup, the Six Nations in 2020. And I think there's genuine reasons why they dipped. And it's mainly around those five Saracens players, to be honest, how match shy they were going into the Six Nations and how they struggled to really get any momentum. So I can understand it. I mean, I don't really see any of those English players that, for me, don't deserve to be in, to be honest. Obviously two hookers an interesting one, but I think Cowan Dickey, in fairness to him, is a very good player, and Jamie George, I would back him all day long. I think his scrummaging and his ability, we just didn't see the best of him. That's in the Six Nations because of lack of match practice, and he's playing now for Saracens in the Championship, so he'll be fine. And those guys can bounce back into form pretty quickly, particularly for something that's going to get them on an emotional pitch like the Lions tour will. So no, I can understand. England for me should be the best of the four nations given the depth they have, and I think it's right that they have the most representation.
We didn't get a chance to chat captaincy earlier. Alan Wynne-Jones, everybody knows, is an unbelievable leader. Worthy of his place in the squad still for you, even in a position with a lot of competition? Obviously, we've seen James Ryan missing out. Do you think the leadership is actually part of the reason why he is there?
No, I think he would have been on the tour anyway. He had a very good Six Nations, obviously. Obviously, captain in Wales to win it. But apart from the leadership aspect, I think he's he's definitely good enough to be in the squad, and obviously now he's going to start, and I have no issue with that at all. I think he's a phenomenal player. He mightn't do as much flashy stuff as someone like Itoje or a big hit like Courtney Laws, or a big carry like Ian Henderson, but in terms of nuts and bolts of second role play, he's top end.
It's interesting. I thought he was a little bit quieter than that in the Six Nations, to be totally honest. I thought there were, look, he captained them to a championship, as you say, and there's not much you can argue with, I suppose, in that regard. But just looking at
he's your Martin Johnson type lock, Gav. He's not somebody that gets headlines, but when you play with him or against him, you know all about it. So honestly, those kind of guys are the clue that you can stick a team around.
How difficult do you think it is to actually be a captain of the Lions? This might sound like a stupid question, but when you've got so many guys who you're going to be meeting for the first time in that kind of a capacity, you know, where you're not just shaking hands with them after a game, you have to spend time with them, get to know them a little bit, you're going to be lining out alongside a few of them who haven't got Lions caps before. Like, how do you go about that as a, from the perspective of somebody like Jones, even off the field, getting to know people? Like, do you have to be kind of a social animal, like actually extroverted, if you like, in getting people on side?
Yeah, he's not actually that type. I mean, Sam Warburton would be a far more comfortable communicator, but what Alwyn Jones has is, he's a really good guy, and he's certainly personable, and he will make a huge effort to get to know everybody. But I think his outstanding feature is just the absolute respect and iconic status he would have, even amongst, you know, other legends or potential legends of the game. That's how well respected he is from everyone who's been involved in elite rugby, and I think that he has that standing, both physical but most importantly in terms of the success he's had, the way he's carried himself, how competitive he is, how hard he trains. So I don't think, and he's obviously been on previous Lions tour and been part of success on the Lions tour, he knows all about it. He knows Gatland very well, and how Gats will kind of try and keep the squad going. I mean, it's a completely unique set of circus, apart from the fans not being there. I mean, they're with coronavirus, keeping the squad happy and what they do off the pitch is going to be incredibly important. And having someone like Alwyn Jones, who has that ability to go direct to Gatland and give his opinion and be able to be a sounding board from advice and ideas from the squad, I think is going to be massive. So that'll be the hardest part. And we've seen other Lions tours when the pecking order becomes clear, how players have kind of jumped ship a little bit and kind of gone off tour but stayed on tour, and they're not going to be able to now. You know, I think they used to just let them go on the piss for a couple of days, get them out of the way, and now they're not going to be able to. They're going to be stuck in the same hotel. So it's really important that everybody buys into this whole, one squad representing the Lions, and you start on the first day and you finish together, because if not, it could end up being, quite toxic quite quickly.
It could be the tour from hell. There'd be a lot of room service cans, you'd imagine,
exactly,
to sustain them over the few weeks. We spoke a bit earlier, the high-profile Irish exclusions, and people can listen back to that. Your thoughts on Sexton's exclusion, Ryan, Ringrose, Stander, and probably a couple more. Sinclair is a person we touched upon, probably didn't get into in great detail, and there were a few more, like Jonathan Davis. I think a lot of people would have been surprised to not see him going. So from those other three nations, who were the standard guys that you would have expected to see there yourself who didn't quite make the plane?
Yeah, it's three. I thought Billy Vunipola would have been in. Again, I'm not convinced on Ali Price. So I would have went for a Danny Kerr, or maybe one of the other Welsh scrum halves, even a Thomas Williams as well, to have, they've gone for two English hookers. I wouldn't be adverse to going for, for two Welsh scrum halves. I think they're very well stacked in that area. Reese Webb, for me, he's a big game player. I think he was very unlucky not to get Six Nations game time. He's very good for the Ospreys. So probably they're the ones that kind of... That jump out of me. Tommy or Johnny May as well. Johnny May, and the English centre, who his name has escaped me at the moment. The English 13,
Slade.
Yeah. Slade. I like Slade a lot. And even the conversation we had earlier in the pod around who's going to play 13, you know, the reason I was struggling was because I thought Slade would be in the squad.
So did I.
Yeah, so Slade's a high profile, you know, exclusion for me.
We did touch upon that earlier, that potential midfield combination and the chances that it actually could be Bundy, Aki at 12 and even Henshaw at 13. There are people out there, they live among us, who think Henshaw's a better 13 than he is 12. I think in recent times there might be an added credence to that line of thought as well, but we didn't quite expand on, say, the idea of Farrell playing at 12. I got the impression from you that you're reticent to kind of commit to that as a good idea.
I think he can play at 12. I mean, you know, you could go with bigger Farrell, and you know, the Sexton Farrell combo worked really well, you know, 4 years ago. So I could see it happening. I worry about Farrell up against you know, a Damien Delande, you know, defensively, and I think the box. I mean, you know, Razzie Erasmus and Springboks haven't played since the World Cup. Obviously, the franchises are only really getting back going now, so it's very unlikely they're going to be able to have a massive shift in terms of tactics. And also they're built around, you know, a very strong kicking game and a very good defense and physicality. So I do think that a 12 jersey, you know, you would need someone who can hold the line there. And Farrell, well, he's very brave. You know, he's not the biggest, and I prefer to see a genuine 12 play 12 and let Farrell and bigger battle it out for 10.
There's a question here that we got on email. Bear with me while I pull it up. This was a question from Sean O'Leary, and he was wondering, with the Lions squad and with the Super Rugby Aotearoa final both on this week, he said he hadn't heard any real discussion around the fact that Gatland lost all 8 of his 8 matches with the Chiefs last year, and since he's left, they've gone straight on to the final this year without him. He hasn't heard mentions of Gatland's performance in his spell there, and was wondering, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, look, obviously it was very difficult for him. They lost a lot of tight games, and it's probably hard to come from where he came from back into New Zealand rugby and understand the personalities, the quality of the players you have. I mean, generally, there's very few foreign coaches coaching in New Zealand Super Rugby, and Gats is obviously a Kiwi, but he's been away a long time. So to go back in there and understand exactly what you have in your squad and understand the competition as well, the Super Rugby competition, which is different than international rugby. It's different than, you know, Lions test matches. So I think there's probably a little bit of an adjustment there. I think the next time he goes back, obviously after this Lions tour, he'll be a lot better prepared. Sorry, it wasn't his fault. He'd be a lot better equipped for that. But I think given the whole thing, I mean, you know, he also blooded some young players who are now playing a role in getting the Chiefs back to the final. So I think it's understandable the way things happened. And also, I mean, let's be honest, it was a very unique Super Rugby competition where they were only playing the Blues, the Highlanders, the Crusaders, and the Hurricanes. Whereas normally they get a chance to go to Australia, get some easy wins there, go to South Africa, get some wins there, and build a little momentum. So when you went on a losing streak in that competition, it was very difficult to turn the tide because you couldn't find that softer game to get confidence and get you back on track. So I think it was a freak year, and I don't see that as being a black mark on a CV forever.
As we start to wind down on the Lions thing, I want to just throw you a couple of questions as well that we got on email that we didn't quite fit into the normal pot. But one last one on the contingent, the Irish contingent within that Lions squad. Looking at a first test against South Africa, how many of those guys do you anticipate would make Gatland starting 15, or if you want to extend it to match day 23, work away?
Okay, so Bundy has a chance. He has a genuine.
Really does.
Yeah, Robbie has a chance. Like, the centres is probably the position of probably least amount of like guaranteed top end. You know, with Davies not making it, with Slade not making it, with George North being injured, and I know Gats fancies him as a 13. So yeah, I could see both those being in. Connor Murray.
Furlong starts, right?
Furlong starts, yeah. Furlong starts. Porter. I think Porter's been brought as an impact bench tight head. And I think Tyke Byrne has got a cracking chance of starting at 6. For me, it'll be Mauro and Alan Wynne-Jones. So I don't see Henderson starting. But yeah, Furlong starting and Andrew Porter having a right shot at being on the bench.
Do you reckon Murray could start at all?
Yeah, he could, but he's just like, again, Murray is capable. I mean, like he's definitely as good as anything that's there. But I do think, I think the Gats likes Gareth Davies. He was brilliant for him at the World Cup. They use him as a shooter, or Gats has used him as a shooter defensively, to great effect. So I think that's, for me, if I was to have €100 now and who's going to be the starting Lions test nine, I'd say it'd be Gareth Davies.
Gareth Davies. Question here from Kalon, and this is about some of the guys who missed out and looking at Ireland summer. Does Birch think that the likes of Sexton, Ringrose, James Ryan should be left out of Ireland summer squad, or at least play little to no minutes because we need to blood guys?
Yeah, I think it is an opportunity, particularly someone like James who has come back from a concussion injury. I don't think there'd be any problems with giving him a summer off. I think it could be a great opportunity to do that. And, you know, we see the Kiwis sometimes giving players sabbaticals at the right time. And I don't think a summer off would harm some of our big game players and give them a break physically and mentally. So, yeah, and it also might give us a chance to dig a little bit deeper and see what's beneath. You know, I think there's a rumour Quinn Roo has signed for Toulon. So he may be out of the picture. But someone like Thornbury, someone like Tom Ahern, for example, could benefit from a shot and it could potentially open up a player who can push his way through to being a real contender for Ireland.
Two final questions, though, that we got on email. I couldn't squeeze them into the regular pod. We'll fly through them here, and I'll let you go, Birch. Thanks a million, as always, for your time. Niall O'Malley said this question might suit you most, and he said, in the aftermath of the loss against La Rochelle, it has been questioned whether Leinster need to play with a style that is high on skill, offloads, and continuity. This aims to reduce the perceived strengths of large, powerful teams to which Leinster have been vulnerable in Europe. In my mind, this sounds like what has been espoused in coaching courses and media as the Leinster way for quite a few years. However, I've been told by someone very familiar with schools rugby that the most successful schools at Senior Cup and supplying Leinster are succeeding on being highly disciplined and structured, with any especially naturally talented players being a cherry on top. Related to this, Noel McNamara, who has been fast-tracked within Leinster and the Irish coaching system, has a reputation for being a prescriptive coach, sometimes at odds with others promoting said Leinster way. So Niall is wondering, does Bernard feel this is a do-as-we-say-not-as-we-do approach from Leinster, or should pragmatism come before aspirational philosophies? What a question.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's interesting, actually. There was a quote going around from the, I'm not massive into soccer, but the Chelsea coach, Thomas Lizelle, is it?
Tuchel.
It's gone around a few of my WhatsApp groups this morning because he spoke about how everyone needs structure, everyone needs clarity. You need roles and responsibilities, and that's how he sets his team up. And obviously, because they're in the final now, the coaches who love that are pushing that as the way forward. And it's probably, there is a split in terms of the coaching ranks, in terms of either you're fully structured or you're fully unstructured. And the reality is, there's opportunities to implement both. I do think the schools, I helped out in my old school last year in Newbridge, and there's some very good teams there, very well coached. And yeah, they are very structured, and I think Leinster are structured. I know Stuart makes a big play on how they want to be brilliant in transition, and you know, they do a lot of game-based training, and they do, but the reality is when push comes to shove, they generally bully teams physically, and they are quite structured, and they don't play a high tempo off. They play high tempo, but they don't play an offloading game. I would say that was probably something that disappointed me watching, was that we weren't able to have a plan B, or I'm sure we had a plan B and a plan C, but it wasn't evident what that was, or we weren't able to implement that in the second half when it was clear we weren't able to go route one. So that's something, again, that the problem is when you're winning every week and you're physically dominating teams, it's very hard to see that coming, you know, and it's very hard to change and potentially lose a couple of games to get better at it. I mean, you know, the famous one is Joe Schmidt, his first, that he lost his first four games trying to change how Leinster played. But after that, it became embedded in the players, and they went on a big winning streak. So, yeah, I think Leinster, unless they change how they recruit, are always going to struggle against. They're always going to come against teams who are bigger physically, and you need to have a way of counteracting that. And someone sent me someone was on to me on Twitter about, oh, like, are the coaches not watching Super Rugby, and why don't we play Super Rugby? You know, we can play Super Rugby because, you know, Super Rugby is great when you have the ball, but what about when you don't have it? You know, you have to adapt to what the opposition are doing. And La Rochelle didn't play Super Rugby against us, Super Rugby type rugby, and you can't avoid that physical dominance. So I do think, yeah, we can make it easier for ourselves with the ball, but without the ball, you're going to have to find a way of stopping bigger, more powerful teams. And that's more than half the problem against La Rochelle, because obviously we conceded, 33 points or whatever. Yeah, we struggled defensively, and that's nothing to do with playing an offloading game or being unstructured in defence, because defences have structure. So, yeah, it's a fine balance, and it's definitely a great conversation that, you know, if we can get back into a pub, snug, pint, and we'll solve the world.
Yeah, we won't record that one, mind you. One last one for the road from Michael Kirk. This came in an email as well. And he was saying, why does it look like the guys can think... let me rephrase this. I think he was trying to say, why does it look like the players can't think on their feet out in the pitch when games start to go against them? Looking at Ulster, they never changed once it was clear that their approach in the second half wasn't working. And similar to Leinster, who never seemed to change their game plan and just hoped something would change for them. It's kind of a question that rears its head every now and then, probably when we get to this stage of the season usually, and we see one or two of those results for the provinces, and I guess we still don't really have answers to it, do we?
No, and I think this is why Johnny Sexton is still so influential. And, like, I don't blame Ross Byrne in any way for the result against Leinster, because the damage was done 1-9 or 1-8. But you would feel that if Johnny played, he would have been better equipped to implement Plan B or Plan C. Maybe he's the one who comes up with it. I changes it mid game. So that's why guys like him are invaluable. Now the other question to that is, you know, we're a nation of intelligent players and highly educated players and highly structured coaches. So why aren't we able to implement change mid game and be able to adapt to that and that to be our unique selling point? So I would agree across both games of the weekend. You definitely felt as a supporter Ulster, particularly the change up they made from the first 20 minutes now, where they were flat out playing high tempo, running off nine, running hard at the gain line, getting over the gain line, they became way more conservative. So, you know, and that wasn't working, and yet they weren't able to change back. So it's definitely a very valid question. And I don't know why we're not producing more, three or four of those in every team. And there's lots of work going into game management groups and leadership development and all that stuff. But for some reason, at the moment, we don't have four or five players who have that ability to read the game as such and make changes on the hoof, which is frustrating and worrying.
Open the pubs, I'd say. We'll get to the bottom of it once they're open. Bresh, thanks a million, as always, for your time and a little bit of extra time as well. Added time, the clock in the red today. Much appreciated.
Okay, thanks, sir.
Thanks to all of the members as well for your questions and the few lads on email. We will be back on Monday. Until then, mind yourselves, take it easy.
I don't think we've met before, but I'm the referee on this field.
Leinster could offer me $5 million a year, I wouldn't go.
It is Tommy Moore!
Rugby Weekly.
Little reverse pass. Oh! Oh!